Disc 1. Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing, by Jed McKenna. Copyright 2002, Wise Fool Press. All rights reserved. This book is dedicated to Walt Whitman. Vitam impendere vero. Stake life upon truth. Juvenal. Chapter 1. That which cannot be simpler. Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. Walt Whitman. She has just finished enumerating for me the many facets of her spiritual journey, and is now looking to me for a response, hopefully approval, perhaps even praise. I don't really take pleasure in dashing the hopes of pretty young ladies, but that's my job. I'm the enlightened guy. So the reason you're doing all these things, I count them off on my fingers, meditating, praying, chanting, yoga, vegetarianism, attending darshan and satsang with realized beings, donating money to Greenpeace, Amnesty International, and Free Tibet, reading classical spiritual literature, purifying yourself, abstaining from sex, and so on. The reason for all this is what? She just stares back at me mutely, as if the answer is too obvious to need stating. But it does need stating. I want it out here, in front of us, where we can examine it and poke at it with our pointy little brains. Well, you know, she begins, still not quite believing I actually want her to state something so obvious. Spiritual growth, I guess. I want to, be a better person, and be able to love more deeply, and, you know, raise my vibrational, you know. I'm hanging on every word. Your vibrational what? Frequency? I want to, you know, raise my level of consciousness, to be more in touch with, you know, my inner self, my higher self. I want to open myself up to the divine energy that's, you know, everywhere. Oh, okay. Why? Huh? Why? Why what? Why everything you just said? Why do you want to raise your levels and be in touch and open yourself up and all that? Well, you know, spiritual, enlightenment. Ah, okay. Is that it? You want to be enlightened? She looks at me like it's a trick question, but it's not. It's the first question. What are you doing? Why are you doing it? Where's this going? If you know, you'll succeed. If you don't, you won't. That's not just pretty talk. That's the law. Yeah, I guess so. I smile reassuringly. Good. So, the reason you do all this stuff is to become enlightened, to achieve spiritual enlightenment. Does that sound about right? A pause. Yeah, I guess. Well, let's just spend a few minutes talking about it and see if we can make it any clearer. What do you think spiritual enlightenment is? She's giving me the big eyes again, but now a bit of perplexity seeps in. It was so obvious a moment ago that it hardly needed asking. Now it's becoming a little fuzzy. Like God, God mind, unity, you know, unity consciousness? It's always like this with new students. They do the student thing, I do the teacher thing. I'm never quite sure why they came or when they'll go. The whole process is equal parts fulfillment and frustration. I talk, they listen. They ask, I answer. I speak, they, who knows, they something. How my words are received, or what becomes of them after they leave my lips, is beyond my ability to control. I speak, that's all. The words flow like song and soothe me. That's my thing. Nodding and maintaining a facial expression that conveys interest and receptiveness is her thing. I'm into the speaking, into my words, and how well they represent the underlying ideas. It would be nice to believe that my words were clicking in her mind like the beads of an abacus, but I know they're not, and I'm comfortable with that. Act, but don't reflect on the fruit of the act, said Krishna to Arjuna. Sign me up. It's very simple, I tell her. Enlightenment is truth realization. Not only is truth simple, it's that which cannot be simpler, cannot be further reduced. I can see from her expression that that got us nowhere. My bad. I have a copy of the Gita on the table between us. I open it at random with the intention of finding a passage well suited to the subject I'm discussing. Works every time. Gratitude permeates me as I read her this statement by Krishna. I am come as time, the ultimate waster of people, ready for the hour that ripens to their doom. The warriors, arrayed in hostile armies facing each other, shall not live, whether you strike or stay your hand. I fall silent as layers of meaning wash through me one after another, and my appreciation causes a swelling in my chest. Wonderful, I think. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. The young girl before me nods, understanding the words at whatever level she is able. She knows that the words are spoken by Krishna and that he is speaking to Arjuna, the mighty warrior who has thrown down his arms rather than signal the beginning of a war that will surely scorch the earth and his own family to ash. She knows that Krishna is revealing to Arjuna the truth of how the world unfolds, and she knows that at the end of this conversation, the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna's delusion will be dispelled, and he will launch the battle. But that's probably as far as her knowledge goes. I doubt she identifies herself with Arjuna, paralyzed by confusion at the start of the Gita. I doubt she equates enlightenment with the direct experience of reality in its infinite form. I doubt she knows that in her own life war is coming, and that she is a breath away from giving the signal that will spark the conflagration that will incinerate her world. I look at this young girl, and I know she has no idea where this road really leads. I smile. Unity consciousness is great, I say, and she looks relieved. Mystical union, being at one with the universe, the direct experience of the infinite, bliss, ecstasy, a taste of heaven, beyond time, beyond space, beyond the ability of any words to describe, the peace that surpasseth all understanding. Wow, she says aptly. Her name is Sarah. She's young, early 20s, and I've just pushed all of her spirituality buttons. If I were a guru, that would be my full-time job. I shudder at the thought. Yeah, she rides on it. That's exactly, but that's not enlightenment. Oh. Enlightenment isn't when you go there. It's when there comes here. It's not a place you visit and then remember wistfully and try to return to. It's not a visit to the truth. It's the awakening of truth within you. It's not a fleeting state of consciousness. It's permanent truth realization, abiding non-dual awareness. It's not a place you visit from here. This is a place you visit from there. For instance, I myself am enlightened. Right here, right now. I am free of delusion and unbound by ego. And although I have had the great fortune of experiencing mystical union on several occasions, I am not presently in that state, and I have no plans to return to it. Nobody resides in a state of permanent bliss, Sarah. That's just something out of a sales pitch. Whoa, she manages. What I'm trying to do here, Sarah, is get you back to square one. You've started off, just like everyone does, in one direction, but enlightenment is in another. What you have to do now is figure out what you really want. Do you want to dedicate your life to the pursuit of the experience of mystical consciousness? Or do you want to wake up to the truth of your being? She spends a few moments thinking about it, and then impresses me with her answer. I guess it makes more sense to figure out what's true first, or else what does it matter, she says. First things first, right? I mean, once I figure out what's true, I can still try to achieve unity consciousness, right? Wow, I laugh appreciatively. Good answer. Yes, figure out what's true, and then you can do whatever you want. Good answers aside, Sarah has not really made the decision she thinks she has. One doesn't select truth realization over mystical union the way one chooses soup over salad. In fact, one doesn't choose enlightenment at all. If anything, one is more likely to be the victim of it, like getting hit by a bus. Arjuna didn't get out of bed that morning hoping to see Krishna's universal form. He was just having a bad day at the office when the universe flashed him. Time to pop the ball back into Sarah's court. So, you're doing all this spiritual stuff because you want to go in a certain direction, right? She nods. You want to develop spiritually, or grow closer to God, or go to heaven, or become enlightened. Something along those general lines. She nods again, looking somewhat bewildered. In short, you're moving, progressing, right? You're heading toward one point and away from another. Another nod. That's pretty much what everybody is doing in the larger sense, wouldn't you say? Moving toward something, away from something else? Another cautious nod, wary, as if I'm setting her up, which, of course, I am. The thing I'd like you to do, Sarah, is tell me specifically what it is you're moving away from and what you're moving toward. Take your time with it. There's no hurry. Treat it like you're writing your own personal mission statement using those two elements, what you're moving toward and what you're moving away from. Okay? She looks a little panicked by the idea. Hey, I reassure her. No worries, Mon. All we're doing is taking a closer look at where you're going and what you're getting away from. It's not astrophysics. Just file your flight plan in the most economical terms. That doesn't sound so hard, does it? I guess not. It's not a race. It's just life. There's no finish line, no winners or losers. Give that some thought, too. It all ties in together. Come see me in the next few days and let me know what you come up with. Sarah labors under the same misconception everyone does. She believes, in the broadest sense, that something is wrong and that she can make it right. What that something is, what's wrong with it, and how it can be fixed all differ from person to person. But the general pattern is always the same. The truth, though, is that nothing is really wrong. Nothing is ever wrong, and nothing can be wrong. It's not even wrong to believe that something is wrong. Wrong is simply not possible. As Alexander Pope wrote, one truth is clear. Whatever is right. Wrongness is in the eye of the beholder and nowhere else. The perception of wrongness, however, is absolutely critical to the perpetuation of the human drama, right up there with the illusion of separateness and the certainty of free will. Drama requires conflict. No conflict, no drama. If something isn't wrong, then nothing needs to be made right, which would mean that nothing needs to be done. Heights need not be scaled, nor depths plumbed. Wealth and power need not be acquired. Future generations need not be spawned. Art need not be created, nor skyscrapers erected. Wars need not be fought. Religions and philosophies need not be devised. Teeth need not be flossed. The belief that something is wrong is the fire under the ass of humanity, is how I explain it to Sarah. Of course, wrongness isn't entirely imagined. A certain amount of rightness and wrongness is hardwired into the human machine. Hunger is wrong. Eating is right. Celibacy is wrong. Seed sowing is right. Pain is wrong. Pleasure is right. And so on. But those are all biological directives, enforceable only within the context of the physical organism. Violations resulting in progressively worsening discomfort and possibly death. Where, then, does wrongness reside outside of our physical organism? And the obvious answer is, nowhere. But if this whole existence thing is to have any dramatic element to keep it interesting, it needs conflict. And so an artificial wrongness must be inserted into the mix. Fear. Fear of the hollow core. Fear of the black hole within. Fear of non-being. Fear of no self. The fear of no self is the mother of all fears, the one upon which all others are based. No fear is so small or petty that the fear of no self isn't at its heart. All fear is ultimately fear of no self. And what is enlightenment, I ask Sarah, but a swan dive into the abyss of no self? She doesn't answer. Fear, regardless of what face it wears, is the engine that drives humans as individuals and humanity as a species. Simply put, humans are fear-based creatures. It may be tempting to say that we are equal parts rational and emotional, balanced between left and right brain, but it's not true. We are primarily emotional, and our ruling emotion is fear. Fun, huh? I ask Sarah, who's looking a bit woozy by this point. When I ask students to define the thing they're heading away from and the thing they're moving toward, it's not because I have any need for those details, or even because I want students to clarify it for themselves. I really just want them to review their present heading. Because if fate or providence has put them in front of me to hear the things I say, then a sharp course change is likely imminent. And that begins with a calling out of the present heading. Sarah gets the light version of this fear and wrongness monologue, partly for her benefit, partly for my own. I don't know how much of it she'll really grasp, but it won't hurt her to hear it. For my part, this is how I figure stuff out, by expressing it. That's how I learn what to say and how to say it. I didn't pick up the total knowledge package with this enlightenment deal, so if I want to understand something so I can teach it, I pretty much have to figure it out for myself. Should I keep meditating? She asks, a little desperate for something familiar she can cling to. Oh, yeah, absolutely, I say, and she seems relieved to hear it. In terms of enlightenment, it doesn't matter much if she meditates or not, or whether she eats meat or not, or whether she gives to charities or steals from them. I know, though, that she has already been destabilized enough for one conversation. The objective of today's lesson is to open her up to a new way of thinking about what enlightenment means. If I start trying to dismantle her false preconceptions too quickly, she'll simply scurry back into whatever Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, New Age mélange she emerged from to find her way here. We're sitting on the front porch of my house amid the endless farmland of America's heartland. It used to be my house, anyway. Now it's more like a rural American ashram project that belongs to everyone who takes part. I used to be the one who cleaned it and maintained it and made improvements and did all the chores. But these days I'm like a prince in his palace. I haven't swung a hammer or emptied a waste basket in years. I never decided to be a prince. It just happened when I wasn't looking, and it's not the sort of thing you can really bitch about. Sarah is not especially unique in terms of the type of people who find their way here. She doesn't arrive with a clean slate, so the first order of business is getting her to loosen her grip on, well, everything. Her opinions, her morality, her most cherished and deeply held beliefs. In short, her ego structure, her false self. Nobody shows up on our doorstep like an empty cup just waiting to be filled with knowledge. And since the knowledge that gets dished out around here is almost certain to be in sharp conflict with the knowledge they arrived with, job one is always prepping them for a major rewrite. At any given time, there seem to be 15 or 20 students living in the house. They stay here for a while. They talk with me. They take care of things. They come. They go. There's another 100 or so who are like day students as opposed to boarders. They don't live here. They just come when they can or when they feel like it. They may come and go without my even knowing they were here. They show up, tend the gardens for a few hours, rewire the basement, prepare meals, build additions, gab with each other, paint things, drop off a gift, eat, whatever. That's how it is around here. It all just flows, and everyone seems pretty comfortable with it. It's a beautiful spring day, late in the afternoon. The sun is dropping, and the heat of the day has softened. A gentle breeze caresses the grass and waves. It's a time to sit in contentment. I am quiet, dwelling in the sweet perfection of the moment, and I'm impressed that Sarah has the sense to do the same, or at least not to spoil it with chatter. Eventually, time swallows the moment, and I observe its passing with gratitude. One of the guys sticks his head out to let us know there's food available for those who want it. I can smell it. The vegetarians have been at it again. Someone brings me a tray with a bowl of rice and dal and some garam masala and a set of chopsticks. As soon as the odor meets me, I know that Sunaya has done the cooking, and I am eager for the food. I eat and watch as the sunset displays more shades of pink than anyone could have suspected. Gradually, the pinks become reds and golds, and the clouds pick up every nuance and light up the sky in a resplendence that promises heaven. I wouldn't mind dying now, I think, as the day dies. But then I remember, I've got a book to write. Chapter 2. Paradox. You will never achieve spiritual enlightenment. The you that you think of as you is not you. The you that thinks of you as you is not you. There is no you, so who wishes to become enlightened? Who is not enlightened? Who will become enlightened? Who will be enlightened? Enlightenment is your destiny, more certain than sunrise. You cannot fail to achieve enlightenment. Were you told otherwise? Irresistible forces compel you. The universe insists. It is not within your power to fail. there is no path to enlightenment. It lies in all directions at all times. On the journey to enlightenment, you create and destroy your own path with every step. No one can follow another's path. No one can step off the path. No one can lead another. No one can turn back. No one can stop. Enlightenment is closer than your skin, more immediate than your next breath, and forever beyond your reach. It need not be sought because it cannot be found. It cannot be found because it cannot be lost. It cannot be lost because it is not other than that which seeks. The paradox is that there is no paradox. Is that not the damnedest thing? Jed McKenna. Chapter 3. Big Thoughts. To meet my thousand, thousand faces, I roam the world. The dirtiest grass wears the sunlight of my skin. I stand in this stream, myself, and laugh. Rumi. Legally, I am the owner of the house. It's a stately and ornate gentleman farmer's house with plenty of room, built in 1912. The story goes that two well-to-do gents had eyes for the same dame, so they each built the nicest house they could. They both proposed to her, assuming that she'd go for the one with the best house. I first heard the story in my lawyer's office at the closing. His secretary was fully versed in my house's history. I waited anxiously to know how it turned out, whether my house won. It did. Sportingly, the other house burned down a few years later. Good story. If it was made up or amended, I don't want to know. I like it just the way it is. The house is in east central Iowa, about 20 miles from Iowa City, and half an hour from the Mississippi River. We're lucky that there's some nice roll to the land here, not completely flat like parts of Iowa can be. We have a few wooded acres and a dozen unwooded acres, a creek, the Mississippi River, a small pond, and we're surrounded by farmland on all sides, an island in a sea of corn. The house has wrapping porches, sweeping eaves, and numerous decorative features for which I don't know the correct terminology. The inside is full of built-in cabinets with glass front shelving, oak floors, ceiling beams, and the kind of detailed craftsmanship that people say you can't find anymore. Anyway, it's an admirable old house, and I haven't seen its like during my dozen or so years in Iowa. That's not to say that it's the biggest or the best or anything like that, just that it's unique and special. Most importantly, it's quiet. The nearest neighbor is more than a mile away, and the nearest paved road is 5 miles away, well out of earshot and eyeshot. I say I'm the legal owner to make the distinction that I nevertheless feel like a guest in the house, a royal guest, but a guest nonetheless. It's Sonea's house, and has been since the first day she entered it. She runs it from top to bottom. She manages the food, maintenance, cleaning, and money. She keeps the guests in line. If it weren't for Sonea, the place would probably have devolved to the condition of a ratty frat house years ago. It's morning now. I'm sitting in my TV room watching world news. I enjoy watching. I'm an observer more than a participant. TV, movies, books, news shows, like Chauncey Gardner, I like to watch. I don't take sides or have any concern for outcomes. It's the drama I enjoy. I don't watch sports or soap operas because that's basically what the news seems like to me, today's crop of zany soap opera antics. Martin comes in and takes the other seat. He's not here to watch the news. There's another TV room in the remodeled basement for the guests to use. Mine is on the second floor and is much more comfortably appointed than the one downstairs. They both get satellite, and the basement isn't exactly a dungeon. But my upstairs room is, thanks to Sinéa, more like one of those home theaters the rich folk have. There are only two chairs, matching overstuffed recliners and double-thickness drapes to block the light. There's a big-screen TV, a VCR, a DVD player, a game console, a surround sound system, and all the electronic bric-a-brac to run it all. Really, a great room, and no doubt unusual for an Iowa farmhouse. It's generally understood that anyone can come in when the door is open and take a seat in the other chair if it's vacant. Whether or not I feel like talking is another matter, and depends largely on whether or not I feel like talking. An interesting news item on Taiwanese independence ends, and I surf through the news channels for something else of interest. There's a lot of financial news at this time of day. I don't care for financial news, or any news, really, unless something big is happening. Nothing big is happening. I check the weather channel for typhoons, tornadoes, hurricanes, or flooding, but everything is calm. Oh, well. "You're wearing shoes," I say to Martin. "Oh, geez," he mutters and takes off his sandals. He slips them behind the chair so Sinéa won't see them if she looks in. But Sinéa sees everything, and Martin knows it. I may be the great enlightened guy they all come to see, but Sinéa is the all-seeing, all-knowing mistress of the manor, and even I am just another dull-witted child in her presence. I'm looking at the TV, and Martin is looking at me. He wants to talk. I suppose I should respond negatively to his attempts to finesse me, but there's nothing on TV, and Martin can be interesting at times. I give him a mildly exasperated nod, and he accepts. "I've made a lot of progress on the assignment you gave me," he spurts enthusiastically. I balk at the word assignment, but it's actually fairly accurate, so I say nothing. "Remind me," I say, although I need no reminding. Martin has spent more than two decades in the thrall of one of the West's better-known spiritual leaders, and has come away with a head full of pseudo-Hindu gibberish as fiendishly entangled as the Gordian knot. I've been trying to ease him towards the Alexandrian solution of slicing cleanly through the knot in a single stroke rather than wasting further decades trying to untangle it. But Martin is slow in letting go of his belief system and the allegiances that came with it. Last time we met, Martin brought a book and read to me several dozen stanzas from the teachings of his former guru. The words were obviously those of a vast mind expounding upon timeless mysteries, and I could easily understand why seekers would flock to one of such limitless insight. But when Martin finished reading, I had absolutely no idea what had just been said. More importantly, although he thought otherwise, neither did Martin. To illuminate this point for him, the assignment I gave Martin was to reduce the selection he shared with me down to a single coherent concept, one lucid sentence. The idea for this assignment came to me as I listened to Martin read his former guru's baffling words with shimmering enthusiasm. I was struck by the exalted sage's ability to mix a few simple concepts together in such a way as to sound sublimely profound without actually saying a whole lot. The passages Martin read to me had to do with the tripartite of perceiver, act of perception, and object perceived, the three gunas of Hinduism, the benefits of silencing the mind, and something about ascending levels of consciousness, each more wonderful than the last. There was probably some overlighting theme that tied them all together into a unified whole that made Martin shimmer. But what the overlighting theme might have been, I can't say, because that would have entailed listening much more closely than I actually did. It was clear to me that Martin was trying to display his mastery over some big thoughts. He also seemed to think that he was educating me, or perhaps acting as self-appointed ambassador to me from his previous teacher. But, like I said, I don't know because I lost track of what he read pretty near the beginning. All I ever really need from a student at the start of a conversation is a flare, a simple locator beacon. The student is traveling from wherever they are at the moment toward the state of abiding non-dual awareness. That journey is what I help them with because I am positioned high above with a clear view of the entire terrain. I always know where the destination is, but I need the student to send up a signal to show me their current position. I just need to get a lock on their location, and I usually have it within the first few words or sentences they utter. For instance, I see where Martin is, and I can see that he has himself twisted up in some brambles. He may feel an urge to describe his current position to me in exhaustive detail, but I already know all I need to guide him out. Martin may want to spend the next 20 years studying the local flora, but I will encourage him to pull out a machete and hack his way out and continue his journey. Sitting next to me now, Martin reminds me about the passages he read to me and my request that he boil it down. I nod and ask what he has come up with. Martin's interpretation of the text and its value was off the mark in the first place, but this little exercise was not really about clarifying the text for him anyway. Rather, it was about coaxing him toward doing his own thinking instead of parroting wisdom-esque concepts and abdicating responsibility for himself to any non-Martin authority. In the course of this process, Martin will probably develop a deeper insight into the knowledge he was twirling and spinning like a fancy six-shooter, but that isn't the point. And, like I said before, Martin can be a pretty interesting guy. He's in his mid-40s, and he's been to a lot of exotic places and done a lot of interesting things. He's a very large man at around 6.5 feet tall and nearly 300 pounds. He's an expert body worker and not a bad cook when Sonea gives up the kitchen for a meal. He's all or part Native American, played college ball for Northwestern, was a Green Beret for 6 years, and a spiritual renunciate for 10. Overall, he's an impressive and likable fellow. He's been in the house for a few months and is generally able to grasp the things he's supposed to and move on. I've known he was stuck on the outside authority thing since he first arrived, but I had never poked at it directly. The last thing I wanted to do was get in a pissing contest about who had the cooler knowledge, his former teacher being a whole different order of magnitude in the guru hierarchy from yours truly. Meaning that if I wasn't careful, I might accidentally send Martin back to the guy who takes 1,200 words and 15 references to ancient texts in 3 languages to say, "What's up?" What Martin came up with for his assignment, I realized within a few seconds, was basically nothing more than a simplified rewording of the original text. He was explaining it, not clarifying or reducing it. "Stop," I say. He stops. "You're just using different words to say the same thing." "Well, yeah," he agrees. "But I'm using less words and explaining it in more Western terms." I flip through the channels and stop to watch Samantha trying to cool an irate Larry Tate. "Why do you think I asked you to summarize the passages you were reading to me, Martin?" "I thought that you were interested in it and might be having trouble, you know, following it," he says. Larry has stormed out, and now Samantha is calling Dr. Bombay, a sure sign that something's amiss, possibly of Dr. Bombay's doing. He's probably turned Darren into a polo pony, and now Larry needs Darren to pitch the big client. Dr. Bombay, however, cannot be reached because he's someplace exotic, riding Darren to victory in the final chucker of the big match. I'm just guessing, of course, but it can't be easy being Darren. Yes, I was having trouble with it, Martin. I sure was. Now, let's try this again. What I'd like you to do is boil this whole complex ganglion of guru speak down to a single, lucid concept. Summarize it. Hack away at it until you reach the core. Reduce it like an algebraic equation. Burn away all the excess and see what's left. Well, Martin begins, and I immediately know we're banging our heads up against his dogged reliance on outside authority. I think that what he means is, I interrupt, what does it matter what he means, Martin? He stares at me with his mouth slightly open. It's your head on the block, Martin. It's your clock that's ticking. I try a different approach. What's your mission statement, Martin? What's the point? What is it you hope to accomplish with your life? Freedom from bondage, he replies without hesitation. Liberation, oneness with all that is, unity consciousness. I manage to not hurl myself out the window. Okay, that's quite a list. Or do you figure those are all different ways of saying the same thing? Well, yes, he replies hesitantly, obviously wondering if I'm an imposter. Those are all different ways of saying enlightenment. Really? How do you know? Well, I've spent over 25 years. What, Martin? You've spent 25 years doing what? Everything. Studying, meditating, purifying myself, reading, attending lectures, learning everything I could about evolving spiritually. It occurs to me that this is exactly where Sarah's current heading will take her. 25 years of unfulfilled searching, all for the want of a little straight talk. What if you were to find out that it was all a waste? I ask him. He recoils, and I sense that he's on the verge of getting up and walking out. Bear with me here, Martin. We're just talking. Just hypothetically, what if you found out that in order to achieve the enlightenment you speak of, you had to reject all the teachings you've ever received? Could you abandon all this knowledge you've acquired? Well, I don't really think. What's your priority? Enlightenment or the knowledge? I don't think. How long has your guru been teaching? Well, over 30 years. And how many of his students have achieved enlightenment? Well, that you know of personally. Well, I never... That you've heard of? It's not that there were rumors of. I don't think... What is it they're doing, Martin? The recipe for enlightenment they're promoting. What is it? Well, meditation and knowledge, basically. And in 30 years, they've never held someone up and said, "Look at this guy. He's enlightened, and we got him there." In 30 years, they don't have one? Don't you think they should have, like, an entire army of enlightened guys to show off by now? Well, it's not. After 30 years, they should have a few dozen generations of enlightened people. Even with only a quarter of them becoming teachers, they should have flooded the world by now, mathematically speaking, don't you think? I'm not asking all this as a teacher myself, mind you. I'm just asking as a consumer, or a consumer's advocate. Don't you think it's reasonable to ask to know a teacher's success rate? The proof is in the pudding, right? Didn't you ask them about the fruit of their teachings when you started with them? Well, that's not... Don't you think it's reasonable to ask? They're in the Enlightenment business, aren't they? Or did I misunderstand you? Do they have something else going? No, but they... If Consumer Reports magazine did a report on which spiritual organizations delivered as promised, don't you suppose that the first statistic listed under each organization would be the success ratio? Like, here are 100 randomly selected people who started with the organization 5 years ago, and here's where they are today. For instance, 31 have moved up in the organization, 27 have moved on, 39 are still with it, but not deeply committed, and 3 have entered abiding, non-dual awareness. Okay, 3%. That's a number you can compare. But this organization of yours would have a big, fat goose egg, wouldn't they? And not just out of 100, but out of hundreds of thousands, millions probably. Am I wrong? You're making it sound, I know I am, Martin, and I know how they respond to this point. They say that everyone is coming up together, don't they? They say everyone's going to burst through at the same time when a certain critical mass has been reached. Isn't that it? Well, kind of, yeah. But you're making it sound, why do you think that organization isn't up to its ass in enlightened people after 30 years? I would think they'd have storage problems by now. I would think the world would be beating a path to their doors by now. How much time do they need? It's not exactly, yes, Martin, it is exactly. That's the point. It couldn't be more exact. How is it possible that after 30 years, the only case of enlightenment is the one that started the whole thing? I know he's a big deal, Martin. I know the teachings. I know the breadth and scope of this guy. I agree that he's an elevated being, whatever that means. If I were in his presence, I would fall to my knees and touch his lotus-strewn feet. He's great. I know it. But we're not talking about someone else. We're talking about you. We're talking about you doing what? What did you call it? Breaking free from bondage? I don't see anyone in this guy's organization breaking free from bondage, Martin. Do you? I wait. Nothing. Can you offer an opinion as to why this might be? Martin is silent. He is clearly battling a lot of internal stuff. He looks at me to see what's coming next. Martin, I think you might consider the possibility that there's a serious flaw in that organization. Something near the core. Do you think it's unreasonable of me to say that? No reaction. Do you think it's at least reasonable to ask? To at least consider the possibility? He nods almost imperceptibly. My own awakening ran its course in less than 2 years, Martin. And that's without any living teacher to help me. I've never heard of the process taking longer than that. I really don't see how the process could take much longer than that. When I say this, I don't mean that it only takes 2 years from the first spark of spiritual longing. I mean 2 years after the point when the process of awakening actually begins, the primary epiphany, the first step. Let's capitalize that, the first step. I know that many people spend many years in meditation and spiritual practice without achieving full awakening. And I know that they think it's because they haven't crossed the finish line yet, but it's actually because they haven't crossed the starting line yet, the first step. I continue. It's a process, and it takes a certain amount of time. About the same as the gestation period for a baby elephant. Martin is too polite to ask the obvious question. How many cases of enlightenment could I take credit for? The answer is an average of 1 or 2 a year since I began teaching. 12 or so total. I can't really take credit for them, of course, but it was to me that the universe guided them at critical stages in their journeys. A couple of them are trying their hands at writing or speaking now, but most are just getting the hang of it. I can see two students in the pipeline at the moment who are going to make it, who have taken the first step. Once the first step is taken, the rest of the journey is sure to follow, unless you die or sustain a massive head wound. Martin. Yes? Would you agree that there might be a flaw in a teaching that doesn't produce any graduates? Right? He hesitates, then nods. If so, it would be a pretty serious flaw, huh? He nods. I nod. Well, that's an interesting possibility. Maybe you could think about that a bit and let me know what you come up with. Okay? He nods. Martin? He nods. I already know the answer. This is for you. Okay? He nods. Allegiance to any spiritual teaching or teacher, any outside authority, is the most treacherous beast in the jungle. The first thing we want to do when we begin our journey is find the companionship and validity that comes with an established group, and in so doing, we effectively end the journey before it begins. Martin is a perfect example of this, and perfectly typical. He set out 20 years ago in search of something higher, and now he's forced to confront the fact that all the effort and all the heart he's poured into his search for all those years has not carried him a single step forward. 20 years he spent digging himself into a hole, and now he has to climb out and begin the journey, which he'll almost certainly not do. The power of our devotion to teachers and teachings is not a reflection of their value, but of the ego's will to survive. It's ego, the false self, that exalts the guru and declares the teaching sacred. But nothing is exalted or sacred, only true or not true. Anyone familiar with the process of deprogramming someone who has been brainwashed by a cult will be able to appreciate what's really involved in breaking free of this kind of allegiance. But there's really only one real cult, the cult of false self, and everyone is a fanatically devoted member. Awakening is the process of deprogramming. Enlightenment is the unprogrammed state. I explain all this in gentle terms to Martin, appealing to his mind, his reason, and watching his discomfort as heart and mind struggle against each other. In my preferred version of the Mahabharata, Krishna and Arjuna are discussing the war that is soon to begin. Arjuna asks if the war will take place on the battlefield or in his heart. "I don't see a real difference," replies Krishna. I don't want Martin to think I'm picking on his group and guru in particular. I don't see any reason to distinguish between one and another. There are any number of reasons why a spiritual organization might not be pumping out the enlightened in droves, not all of them readily visible. One very good reason is that, unbeknownst even to themselves, the members of any spiritual organization may be quite satisfied to simply pursue enlightenment. Dedicating one's life to lofty spiritual ideals is every bit as life-defining and purpose-giving as the quest for heaven, or power, or money, or love. Just because there's a flashing neon sign above the door that says, "Free enlightenment, the shortest and easiest way, the one true path," doesn't mean that what goes on inside is really about enlightenment, or that the people who go in really want it. Quite the opposite. In nearly all cases, the enlightenment being bought and sold is not truth realization at all, but a state of consciousness so crazy-ass wonderful that you'd have to be an idiot not to want it. So insidiously wonderful, in fact, that its radiance has blinded untold millions of seekers to the fact that it doesn't exist. So maybe Martin's former organization is more into the talk than the walk. But I don't believe that they're perpetrating any sort of intentional fraud. I think they're just as convinced as those they convince. In these cases, it's not likely to be anything sinister, so much as an organization behaving like an organism that seeks to survive, adapt, and grow. Maybe the organism seeks liberation for all beings, or world peace, or the expansion of its own doctrine, or simply its own exaltation and empowerment. Maybe the enlightened guy at the top just wants to get laid. Or maybe he lost control of the organization to the unenlightened guys below. Or maybe the enlightened guy at the top isn't enlightened at all, but something else. Something truly wonderful, perhaps, but not awake. Not truth realized. Or, hey, who knows? Maybe Martin's former group will reach their critical mass and they'll all burst into permanent, super happy consciousness together. Boy, will I have egg on my face when I'm knocking on their door asking if it's too late to sign up. The point is that there's really no point in trying to figure out all the possible reasons why seekers don't find. It's just another distraction, and there's no shortage of those. The point is to wake up, not to earn a PhD in waking up. Simply put, as Sarah surmised, waking up is job one. And then, if you still want to liberate all beings or promote world peace or save the whales, great. Lucky beings, lucky world, lucky whales. But the bottom line remains the same. You're either awake or you're not. Chapter 4. Placid and Self-Contained. I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied. Not one is demented with the mania of owning things. Not one kneels to another, nor to his kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or unhappy over the whole earth. Walt Whitman. Chapter 5. Done. Long enough have you dreamed contemptible dreams. Now I wash the gum from your eyes. You must habit yourself to the dazzle of the light and of every moment of your life. Long have you timidly waited, holding a plank by the shore. Now I will you to be a bold swimmer. To jump off in the midst of the sea, rise again, nod to me, shout, and laughingly dash with your hair. I am the teacher of athletes. He that by me spreads a wider breast than my own proves the width of my own. He most honors my style who learns under it to destroy the teacher. Walt Whitman. The most recent visitor to the house to accomplish full awakening was Paul. For the last 2 weeks he was here, I didn't speak to him at all. I only saw him occasionally as he went off for walks or while he sat on one of the garden benches amid the blowing snow. That doesn't mean that's all he did. That's just all I know about. I don't go down and hang out with the guests much, and I'm sure that far more goes on in this house than I'll ever know about. I would guess, however, that Paul wasn't doing a lot of socializing during this period. It was winter when he told me. A crisp night, but not frigid, fresh snow on the ground. One of those nights that all the stars came out for, in a crystalline vision that awed the wind to stillness. A night so clear and silent that it felt staged. A perfect winter evening, like we see here maybe once or twice a year. That's why I was out walking in it. At a crossroads a couple of miles from the house, Paul joined me. I was pleased to see him. I'm always pleased to see anyone when they get where I believed Paul was at that point. He joined me silently, and we walked on. It was 10 minutes before he spoke. "I'm done." I smiled as warmth poured through my heart. Warmed by the memory of the day, I came to the same startling and improbable conclusion for myself, and warm for the times I had heard it from others. Warm knowing the journey one takes to arrive at such a place, and warm knowing what lies ahead. That's how it is when you get there. No bells and whistles, no radiant backlighting, no choirs of angels. As Layman Pang put it, you're just an ordinary fellow who has completed his work. "I have no more questions," Paul said. He didn't just mean he had no more questions for me. He meant that he had no more questions, period. That's how it is when you get to the end. You're just done. What he wasn't saying, though he could have, was that he now knew all there was to know. Everything. He had arrived at the end of knowledge and now possessed the only perfect knowledge. He wasn't saying it because it's too big to say, but I knew he was thinking it because it was true, and it's too big not to think. We continued walking. The moon was 3/4 full and lent a radiant sheen to the fresh snow spread like a satin sheet over a slumbering earth. Paul didn't say anything else until we got back to the house. It occurred to me that he had probably been done for a few weeks and had spent the time getting accustomed to this new and unexpected state. That's how it is at the end. Even if you've been told 1,000 times that there's an end to knowledge, to seeking, you're stunned and perplexed when you reach it. You've spent a few years fighting battle after battle, each more grueling than the one before, and never, never, with any expectation whatsoever, that you'll ever really emerge victorious in this life. And then, one day, there it is. Nothing. No more enemies. No more battles. The sword that seems welded to your hand can now be dropped, once your fingers can be pried from it. There's nothing left to contend against, and nothing left that must be done. And there will never be anything that must be done ever again. Even then, it's very possible that you don't know what you are or where you are. It's just over, and nothing comes along to replace it. In novels, you see freshly converted vampires wondering what their new status entails. Am I a vampire or just nuts? What's the deal with garlic and crucifixes and sunlight and coffins? Am I immortal? How do I verify it? What's true and what's myth? It can be like that. I've heard that the Zen guys say it takes 10 years to get the hang of it, and for them that means 10 years in the most conducive imaginable environment, a Zen monastery where it's all enlightenment, 24/7, 365. Imagine, on the other hand, spending that adjustment period in the midst of a society that devalues spirituality, and in which even the spiritual experts are unwitting masters of disinformation. That can be a damned peculiar 10 years. And what comes after? Well, as I understand from practitioners of Jnana Yoga who have spoken to me of it, my apologies to them and anyone else whose teachings I'm distorting in this book, one emerges from that 10-year period of assimilating as a Jnani, one who knows. That's what I am, I suppose. But the process of reduction that brought me from Ajnani to Jnani is not over. Even now, it takes a conscious effort to maintain my false self, my dream character, to animate it, to keep it running. And this trajectory I'm on will take me as close to non-existence as anyone can get and still have a body. In other words, I will continue to channel progressively less and less energy into my dream state being. My teaching will reduce down to its most refined and least tolerant form. My interests will withdraw from the world, and I will become as minimal as a person can be. Whether or not Jnana Yoga or Zen Buddhism or any other system confirms this process is moot, because I confirm it myself, directly. I don't defer to teachers or teachings. I see myself receding in this manner. Writing this book has accelerated the process, but this is where the road has always led. When Krishna finished what he came to do, he entered a forest and just kept walking until he collapsed from fatigue. A passing hunter mistook his feet for the ears of a deer and killed him with a single arrow. That walk might be viewed as the progressive withdrawal of energy. So maybe when my time comes, I'll just walk off into the tall corn until I drop from fatigue and have my feet mistaken for ripe ears of corn by a passing John Deere harvester. End of Disc 1.